We hear often about the big downsides created by the online worlds, eroding democracy and the self-esteem of teenagers. But the small things we used to do before the internet are often overlooked, says Pamela Paul. She's editor of the New York Times Book Review, and she reminds us about the small ways we've changed the way we think of ourselves and others since the dawn of the internet more than 20 years ago. Her new book is called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet, and Pamela Paul joins me now. Hi there.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you. Let's begin with a yin. In what ways do you think the world has changed for the better thanks to the internet?
Well, let's talk about the most obvious in the last year or two. We've all lost track of time, which is during the pandemic, I think the internet was a savior. I mean, really and actually, literally a savior for many people. When we were all under lockdown, it gave us obviously access to health information, connection to loved ones, enabled us in really unfortunate circumstances to attend funerals remotely. It enabled those who were able to work remotely to continue to earn a paycheck and be able to support themselves. So it's obvious that there are huge upsides to the internet. And, you know, then there's all the little fun things to the internet. And I am, you know, as guilty as anyone in enjoying them probably a little bit too often, whether it's for me, the big plus is finding the answer to any question. It's, you know, kind of amazing. Remember when we had to go to the library to look at an encyclopedia to figure something out, or just to like wring your hair over trying to figure out who that actor is in a movie, and you just like could not remember. So all of that is to the good.
Yeah, worth remembering, as you point out, that in 1918, when the pandemic hit, working from home was not really an option, right?
Right. It was a really different thing, you know, when you were truly isolated. Now, again, there's a downside to that, too, because sometimes you want to be left alone, right?
Speaking of those downsides, given that new technology and innovation is always disruptive, can we ever really know what the trade-offs will be before we take the plunge into something new like the internet?
You know, I don't think that we can. I think that it's really only with time that you begin to see all of the downsides. And one of the interesting things about the internet is that it's really habit forming. It's amazing how quickly we adopt online habits. I mean, I don't know about you, but even just, again, going back to this last year or two, we've become so adept at remote work. Many people don't even realize, like, they're not sure how they're going to go back to working in real life, to working at offices. And yet we spent decades working in offices. Suddenly, you know, with the internet, we become very quickly acclimated to a different way of doing things.
Are you intentional about the technology you use and what you do with it?
Absolutely. I think everyone really should be. I mean, one of the things we lose sight of, even though we all know about, you know, big tech, is that technology isn't a public service or a public good. It's not an inevitable future. It's an industry. The technology, you know, everything online essentially is a product or service that you can choose to use or not to use. In the same way, you can choose to buy a certain skin cream or take a particular vacation and go to a certain hotel or wear a certain article of clothing. And I think that we forget that it's our choice whether we want to download a new app or go to a new website or start using a new CMS at work. We're in charge of those decisions. One of the things that's been so effective about the technology industry is that it, like, the marketing message they send to us as users makes us feel bad about not using technology in a way that I think we're a little bit more skeptical if it's like a piece of clothing. But what the tech industry says is you're a Luddite, you're denying the future, you aren't embracing 21st century skills, you're backwards. And we tend to believe them, which is kind of unusual.
I'm hoping I've got a sympathetic audience for this, given your job as editor of the New York Times Book Review. But there's a difference in the quality of information that you get from technology and the quality of information you get from a book, right? And often that's inextricably linked to the medium. So people distributing information via technology have different incentives to people writing books, for a start.
Right. I mean, look, there's a lot to say about getting information online that's good, right? And we get a lot more information online than we do offline nowadays. But let's just take book reading, for example. And I want to talk about this both with adults and also children. All of us tend to absorb information better when it's in a printed book and retain it better when it's in a printed book than when we look at it, when we look at words online. You know, when we look at text online, we tend to scroll ahead, we skip around, we look for search words, we skip to another tab because we get distracted or we're drawn in by a notification, and you don't have that kind of deep focus that you do with the physical object of a printed book. And I think that's particularly concerning when you think about kids and the way they're learning, because many schools, for example, have dropped physical textbooks in favor of electronic textbooks, often for financial reasons. And the industry has been very effective in terms of selling schools on e-textbooks. But the research shows that children do not learn as effectively. And again, I think any grown-up knows this in their heart of hearts, because you don't retain information as well when you're looking at it online.
And your book is called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet. And that's more than just nostalgia, right? What did you want to achieve by listing them?
Well, you know, some of it is nostalgia, and some of it is, you know, good riddance. There's a lot of stuff that it's kind of nice to get rid of. I mean, think about losing your ticket, right? That's one of the chapters in the book. You don't lose your ticket anymore. It's on your phone. I mean, of course, you can lose your phone. Of course, I guess sometimes you kind of wanted to lose your ticket or at least have an excuse not to go to something. But, you know, for most people, you don't want to lose your train ticket. You don't want to lose your ticket to the theater. So that's gone. But I wanted to also do two things. One is, for those of us who were there in the before times, before the internet, remind us of what it is we used to do before we were glued to our phones. And of course, it's not really a telephone, it's a portable internet. What did we used to do before we used that as an alarm clock, before we were in like four different group texts, often texting people at the same time, and kind of recall that and make us remember that, because again, it enables us to make a choice. And then secondly, for people who are too young to have experienced it or to remember, for the digital natives, it's like a little walk through prehistory for them. Uh-huh. And all of this has happened so quickly and so completely that I don't think a lot of adults, you know, who, again, were here before, realize the extent to which things have changed, the extent to which they're different for those who were born into it.
Do you miss being bored?
I do miss being bored. You know, look, being bored is boring, but it's also useful. You know, it's useful. It's important to have that downtime. I think that we are all sort of enduring, sometimes welcoming, but enduring an onslaught of information. There's all this input coming in, right? It's constant. I usually have about 22 tabs between two computers and my phone up at any given time. And there's constant notifications. There's constant updates. There's a lot to absorb, not just in terms of like the movie tonight will be at 8 p.m., but also these emotional things that kind of have you like with a kind of emotional whiplash all day. Like you find out, oh, this person's uncle has died, and oh, this person didn't like your photo, and this person has unfriended you. You know, you're just kind of whipping back and forth between positive and negative emotions. It's a lot to take in.
What about being alone? Do you miss that?
I do miss being alone. One of the interesting things about the internet, and here's where I try to really look at things, kind of turn them in my hands and look at them in from different angles, and also think, well, not everyone's like me. Like, what would this be like for this other person? So you're never alone. You're never the only one. You never have solitude online, because you can always find people who share whatever weird passion it is that you have, whether it's creating 19th century boats out of popsicle sticks, or, you know, an interest in making baked goods from cornmeal, like whatever your thing is, you'll find that there are thousands of people who do exactly what you do or who are just like you online. And that can be really great, or can be really comforting. If, for example, you have a child with a rare genetic disorder, you can easily connect with other people who have that experience online. But what you lose is sometimes that feeling of not having like a horde of 10,000 people knocking on your virtual door, and that feeling of, if I wake up in a hotel room in a strange city traveling by myself, I am really just with me. There's no one looking at me through my posts online. There's no one waiting for me to respond to my email. I am just truly alone, because now the world is in your back pocket. And here's the other thing. If that world is not knocking at your door and liking your photos, upping your posts on Reddit, whatever it might be, you can feel lonelier than you would have if there'd been no internet there at all.
I'm speaking with Pamela Paul. She's editor of the New York Times Book Review, and her new book is called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet. One thing you list that might be contrary to conventional wisdom is that we have lost our ability to have unpopular opinions. What's the point you're trying to make there?
Well, actually, I think that's a really profound point. And I think anyone who has spent like an unhappy hour on Twitter or has experienced, you know, the horrors of being ratioed or having something that you say really take an issue with online, because, of course, tone doesn't necessarily come through. Irony doesn't always come through. Sarcasm, you know, those sort of nuances and tone don't translate in a text. It's really quite devastating. And I think what you end up is a kind of flattening and homogenization of views. Now, of course, it all depends on what silo you're in, right? So for each silo of opinion, for each vacuum, whether you're on the left or on the right, or, you know, in some variation of or in some micro community, there are rules to obey. And if you stray from the rule of what can be said or should be said and what's verboten, you will know right away. And there's very little nuance to, you know, the outcry that will descend upon you if you venture forth with some unpopular opinion. One of the interesting things, I think, again, for kids is that they're learning this from a really young age, because everything they do online is subject, and everything they do is online, is subject to an incredible amount, not just of, like, you know, direct peer scrutiny, but their peers' social circles and the social circles after that. It's like being under constant watch by a huge community. And if you dare say anything that is risky or different, you risk really being shouted down. So kids are learning to be risk averse and really safe at a time when they're just developing who they are. They're learning what their opinions are. That's when they should be taking risks. That's when they should be having, you know, wild opinions and testing ideas out. But it's really hard to do that when you have a kind of crowd ready to descend upon you.
A smaller but nonetheless tangible loss is the loss of what we in New Zealand call the full stop. Americans call it the period. And this might have only been a year or two ago that we realized that the full stop has actually become, for some people, a passive-aggressive punctuation
mark.
Yeah,
or even aggressive-aggressive.
Yeah.
yeah, everything has an exclamation point. I mean, and I think it's changing the way we write, even when we're not online. Because, look, if you send an email to someone that says thank you and it has a period, think about when you get that. If you got that email in your inbox, what does that say? I mean, it's like a slap in the face getting a period at the end of a thank you, or have a good weekend, or I really enjoyed that. It sounds pissed off. It sounds lackluster. It sounds sarcastic and annoyed. And that's really transformative, because, you know, when I was growing up, you were supposed to use exclamation points with discrimination. You know, you're supposed to be very careful with how many exclamation points. Yeah. Now, sometimes I find it's hard not to add two exclamation points, because one seems kind of wan. You know, it's remarkable. And then just to include the period, it's better to leave it off in texts. I remember at the New York Times, you know, when we all started using the Twitter, we were using it with Times style. And everybody, of course, working at a news organization, a newspaper, people who are fans of style and grammar would use periods. And then there was a kind of notice that went around a few years ago that said, ixnay on the period or the full stop. You know, we don't use those anymore. That is not Twitter style. So that's a big change.
Yeah. This is such a great list, by the way. And some of them make you think, hey, like, is losing the blind date Is that net positive or net negative? I'm not sure.
I think it's complicated. I don't know if it's either. I think it's a mix and it depends on the person. But we're all pre-screening one another, right? So that saves you a lot of bad dates, but it also saves you or sort of spares you or doesn't afford you the opportunity to be with someone who maybe didn't look good in the photo, but actually is kind of attractive in real life to you, or maybe doesn't share your religious background. And so you sort of cross them off of Tinder from the beginning, but actually maybe you're a little bit more open-minded than that. So you're not really sort of, you're not opened up to a lot of possibility and opportunity. It's like we are editing those things out of our lives before they can even really happen.
And what about bad photos? We don't really see bad photos of people anymore. What does that mean for us?
Well, it's funny. Again, obviously, there's a positive side. Your photo albums. Well, no one has photo albums either. But your Instagram feed or whatever, it looks perfect, and you're gorgeous all the time. On the other hand, it's kind of nice to see people looking just like normal human beings. I mean, it's funny. Again, going back to quarantine, it was really humanizing to see, like, oh wow, people are in real homes with children who interrupt and animals who walk on keyboards and walls that are less than ideally decorated and plants that are dying in the background. It's kind of nice to see the reality, the humanness of us. And you don't get that when every photo can be, filtered and perfected into some kind of, image that just doesn't reflect reality.
So, Pamela, we can't go back. How do we go forward?
Well, I think the internet forces us into a fast forward motion no matter what. I think we're constantly forced into thinking, what does this mean for tomorrow? There's this new app, there's this new thing. How do I adapt? What do I do? What does this mean? I think what you can do is pause, pause, think back, wait a minute, how did we get here? And also stop and think before you make a decision with regard to technology. Am I unhappy with the way this works right now? Am I unhappy? For example, I was out for a meal with someone the other day, and at the end they said, "Well, okay, you Zelle me or Venmo me, the amount, we'll split it that way." And I said, "I don't use those." And they were shocked. And I said, "I just think it's kind of nicer to I'll treat you this time and you treat me the next time. It's nice to be treated. We don't have to, have this kind of very swift division. It kind of takes away that possibility of offering something to someone else and then leaving open the window that there'll be a next time. So I think it's making those conscious choices that you can, some of the things that I listed in these 100 chapters, some of these things you can recuperate, or you can decide not to lose at all, or you can decide to tailor to your own life. It's not that these things are all required. I just hope people are a little bit more conscious about them.
Yeah, it's resisting the transactionality of the internet and the way it commodifies and reduces human relationships to these transactions, right?
Exactly what I said. Yes, perfectly put.
Hey, great to chat to you. Thank you for this book. You've done a really great job, and it's called 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet. And I've been talking to editor of the New York Times Book Review, Pamela Poole. Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you so much for having me.